It's been a pretty interesting few weeks, really. I've learnt how to do a whole load of new things. But one of the things that really has occurred as this summer's gone on is that Synchro and I feel that it would be a good time to start taking control of our diet, improving the quality of what we're eating, and endeavouring to go through what we've heard described for many years as detox processes, and making sure we've got the right nutrients and all of that. Which brings me on to tonight's show, when I'm very pleased, hopefully very shortly, to be joined by Clive DeCarle to talk about some of the simple techniques we can use for improving our health and keeping ourselves healthy, because one of the conclusions that I seem to keep reaching is that really the only place that any significant change can truly be made is within the self. Any other change that is going to occur will occur as a result of that. And what better place to start than with what we're absorbing, what we're getting rid of, and what we're eating. So I'm going to put on another 3 minutes or so of music, give you a bit of CC Smugglers and How Long, whilst I call Clive up, and I will be back with you very shortly. Ta-ra for being there, folks. That was Magnifico and Turbulenza and Here I Come, Here I Go. Well, I'm hoping we've got the problems sorted with the Skype, and that I'm now joined on the line by Clive. Welcome to Dr. Rock's radio show. Clive, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Well, as you know, because we had a detailed chat a bit earlier in the year, I'm now very interested in many of the different modalities that you talk about, and actually kind of trying some of them out and seeing how they work for me. But I was wondering, first of all, how come you became involved in such a deeply alternative school of knowledge?
Well, I was always interested in the alternative and esoteric side of things. And when I was in my early 20s, for about 3 years, I studied at an esoteric school which taught you to see auras and taught you how to do hands-off healing and that kind of stuff. And while I never did anything with it, people used to tell me that I was quite good at it, but I did a number of things, but I really went into ophthalmic optics. And I was in the middle of a career in ophthalmic optics when I went from being super healthy to almost dead, and I made one small error. I went to a doctor, and the doctor gave me antibiotics, which I didn't need at all. What I actually needed was to change my diet. I only went to the doctor because I had spots on my face, and aged about 30, I was really embarrassed about them. And the doctor said, oh, I can give you antibiotics for that, soon sort you out. And it soon sorted me out. Suddenly, after a few weeks, I noticed my various vision problems. Then I noticed I'd got arthritis, and then I noticed I couldn't drive my car. Then I noticed I couldn't do anything. And then one morning, my wife brought me a cup of tea, and I couldn't lift it up. It was just ridiculous. And I tried to put my socks on to get out of bed, and I couldn't. So they put me in hospital, and by that time, I'd become type 1 diabetic. I looked like I was 90 with arthritic limbs all over the place. And it was just a joke. And for 3 weeks, they kept me in hospital. And they kept on trying to offer me drugs and stuff and injections of things. And I wouldn't have any of it because they didn't know what was wrong with me or why it had happened. And I was quite surprised that after 3 weeks, they still hadn't worked out why it had happened. It was only later that I realized it was antibiotics, when other people said, oh, I became type 1 diabetic and got arthritis after I had the same antibiotic. So
all of this, I mean, apart from whatever the original problem was, all of this came about as a result of those original antibiotics?
Exactly. I just had one round of antibiotics and my whole body fell apart. And even now, 30 years later, while I cured myself of the arthritis with vitamins and minerals, that was quite easy. I'm still type 1 diabetic because, whereas type 2 diabetes, you can cure in 3 weeks. Type 2 diabetes isn't even a disease. Type 2 is just bad eating and toxicity and so forth. But type 1 is, you know, supposedly permanent damage. I'm happy to prove that wrong, but that's what it seems at the moment. So I wasn't happy with doctors at all. Very unhappy, in fact.
Was there ever a time, do you think, when we knew what diabetes was, we knew that it's what you're describing rather than what we're told it is now, or is this kind of new? Because a lot of what we're going to be talking about has actually been known for quite a long time, hasn't it?
Well, you know, not only have all the answers been known for a long time, but a lot of what the doctors would say are diseases aren't. They're lifestyle choices, bad ones. You know, diabetes type 2 barely existed 100 years ago. It was really rare. And it was never, ever seen in young people. It was a disease of old people who'd usually indulged too much in the wrong sort of foods. Alzheimer's didn't exist. It was this just in the last century that Professor Alzheimer saw this new disease called, and he had to call it after himself. Nobody had ever seen it before in the world. And similarly, heart attacks hardly ever happened. Cancer hardly ever happened. You just go back 150 years ago, and people, in the main, they either died in the first 4 years of life or in childbirth, or they lived on average to 80, 90. You know, a visit to any graveyard will show you that when the government says, oh, we're living twice as long as we used to, that's simply because they've cheated the statistics, put child death together with total old age, and come up with a number in the middle. Somewhere between 0 and 90 is 45. And now,
that can seriously disturb your averages, that kind of behaviour.
Well, you know, if you invite psychopaths to be your government, they will lie and cheat.
Yes, I mean, it's almost as if somebody's been creating the diseases to satisfy the needs of the health service itself.
Well, imagine that.
So, having realised after, I mean, what sort of things were they doing to you to try and diagnose you in the hospital? Because this must be quite a while back now.
But yeah, it was 30 years ago, and they put me in a special observation ward. Because what was happening was that throughout the night, I'd be fine for an hour or two, and then I'd get an incredible temperature and sweat so much they had to change all the bed sheets and everything. This happened several times a night, so they'd wake me up in the middle of the night and take blood to see if it was some parasite or to see if it was some tropical disease. Or, you know, they were very, very, very thorough. You know, I mean, I was very impressed. All the people were very nice. Some people have horrible experiences in the NHS hospital. I had a brilliant experience, except they had no knowledge that it was a deficiency. I was low on magnesium and a few other things, but they don't get taught magnesium in medical school, except if you're an emergency room doctor. You know, the GPs know nothing. They're actually not taught. I met a GP at a friend of mine's party, and I asked her, she was about to qualify in 3 weeks' time, take her exams. And I said, what did they teach you about magnesium? 6 years of study to be a doctor. She said, nothing. I said, well, you must know something about magnesium. She said, no. You know, we do half a day on nutrition and minerals and vitamins and amino acids and so on. And they didn't mention magnesium in the half a day.
Half a day on vitamins and minerals.
And nutrition in general.
Mm.
So, you know, I hear all the time from people who said, well, I said to the doctor, what I eat, you know, that must be important, mustn't it? And the doctor said, no, it makes no difference. As if what you eat doesn't become you. I mean, yesterday's lunch is tomorrow's brain. You know, it's obvious that you are what you eat. But according to most doctors, it's just an irrelevant thing. You know, you go into a cancer ward and they're serving to the patients with cancer ice cream and donuts and stuff like that. Whereas, you know, in 1925 rather, Dr. Otto Warburg, who won the Nobel Prize, discovered that the only thing that cancer eats, the only thing it eats is sugar. And they're serving cancer patients sugar. It's insane, you know. But that's because they don't teach the Nobel Prize winning work these days. Because if they did, they wouldn't make enough money in cancer, so-called cures. Not, you know.
No, it's quite funny, really. I've been experimentally asking people what they know about what causes cancer. And most people, in fact, I think almost everybody has responded to the question with smoking. But I don't think other causes for cancer are widely known.
Well, the thing is about disease is it's you know, doctors would tell you, oh, you're ill because you've got a virus. You're ill, you've caught cancer, and now it's a battle between you and the cancer. But the reality is, and this can be hard for some people to grasp, that there are some cases where the body will invite a virus in. Now, cancer is a good example of that. Let me give you an Italian example. Outside Rome, there was a marshy area in the last century called the Pontine Swamps, and their malaria and malarial mosquitoes were rife, just you know, not far from Rome. There was still malaria in the last century, and they decided they'd drain the swamps, fill them in, and stop the mosquitoes and the malaria, which they did. Now, what was the result of them doing it on the health of the population? Now that malaria wasn't so much of a problem, did they die less or more? They died more. And what did they die of? Well, prior to draining the swamps, the people who lived in the Pontine area really didn't get cancer, not like the Romans did just down the road. But when they drained the swamps, within a short period of time, the cancer rate rocketed and became similar, the same pretty much as Rome. So why? What had changed? Well, what had changed was the people stopped getting the fevers from the malaria so often. And you know, as the young people grew up and after the malaria had gone, they no longer got the fevers that they would have got regularly with the recurrent malaria they had down there. So what it was that if you've got some sort of problem in your body, one of the body's best defenses against any sort of problem is to raise a temperature. And so if you raise a temperature, it's been known for over 100 years that a rise in temperature, cancer cells don't like that. Basically, your body can go up to a temperature of what? 36 degrees, is it? Something like that? Or 46 degrees? My mind's gone blank briefly.
Yeah, I can't remember it. I was told when I was younger, but I haven't got a clue now, tell you the truth.
37 is about normal. So we can actually go up to something like 46 before we expire. But over 43 degrees, cancer cells can't live. So if you can raise the body with hypothermia up to over 43 degrees in the area where the cancer just can't survive. So the people in the Pontine swamps, they were getting these incredibly high fevers, wiping out the cancer. So once they stopped the fevers, then the cancer stopped. So, you know, should you be scared of viruses? You know, the medical profession says, yes, you should be very scared of viruses. Ebola virus could kill you. Oh, dear. You could get all these nasty viruses, from smallpox to anthrax to leprosy, you name it. And they say, oh, you've got to be scared of the viruses, and this is rubbish. You don't have to be scared of any virus. What you have to be concerned about is whether your immune system is strong or not. Because if you have a strong immune system, no virus is going to touch you. You could walk through a leper colony, give everybody a big smack kiss on the lips, and you'd be fine if you had enough vitamin C, vitamin D, zinc, all the vitamins and minerals and so on in perfect balance. So it's not the viruses that are scary, it's your ability to be healthy. That's the point.
Which is one of the things I really love about your approach, is that it is taking a simple view of the thing, and it seems to make a lot of sense. And you've clearly in your years had a lot of experience of using these techniques with people, and I guess that's probably where you went, is it? Once you decided the doctors didn't know what they were doing, who did you turn to for help?
Well, I went to a guy now who's very famous, written 35 books. He was very young at the time, younger than me, was in his 20s, called Patrick Holford, you know, now a very famous English health advisor. And, as I say, I'd worked out that I was low on vitamin and minerals, and he told me exactly which ones I needed. And, you know, I owe really my life to him, because you know, the doctors had really written me off and were telling me I'd be in a wheelchair and they'd be cutting my legs off and all this rubbish. You know. It's just not the way to cure arthritis. You know.
Certainly not. So how had you worked out that you were low on vitamins and minerals? How did you reach that?
Reading books. I got some books. You know, my wife found me books, and you know, I'd got a rough clue because I was very lucky when I was young. For some reason, I fell into a crowd of friends who were into macrobiotics and all sorts of things. And you know, I'm 61 now, so you know, almost 45 years ago, I got introduced to all sorts of concepts which were really rare at that point, relatively. So I was very lucky. So I got to learn a lot of esoteric stuff quite early.
I guess it's when those ideas were just reaching the West, isn't it, really?
Yes, I think so. So, Patrick, anyway, by the time I got to my 30s, Patrick Holford taught me what to do, and he said, you know, reasonably simple things, like those two Mars bars you're eating during the day, along with the sandwich, really aren't doing you a lot of good, and I think he was probably right. So I did change my diet and got a bit more sensible.
Did it change all at once, or did you do it a bit at a time?
Well, I was forced to change because I became type 1 diabetic, and if I broke the rules and ate something too sweet, I paid the price and didn't feel happy. So, you know, I was forced to pay attention to my diet.
Mm. It's interesting that, isn't it, really? Because when I, in my readings about how to keep myself healthy, one of the main menaces that I come across again and again is sugar, sweets, especially kind of what they call chocolate in the West, that actually it really is very bad for us. And, you know, even if you ain't getting the symptoms, it's not good stuff to be doing.
Well, you know, we all have to have glucose in our bodies, and we can get that from, you know, vegetables. You know, it doesn't have to be something that's hugely sweet, you know, because a potato or a sweet potato, for instance, is going to turn to sugar. Lots of things turn, all the carbohydrates turn to sugar. But so how much do we need? We need less than 2 teaspoonfuls in equivalent terms of glucose in our body at any one time. So let's say somebody drinks a Coca-Cola. That's got, roughly speaking, I believe, 16 spoonfuls in. So just one soft drink can give you 8 times more glucose in the body than you're meant to have. And that's a lot. You know, 8 times more of anything you're meant to have in your body can really affect things.
And there's a lot of people who drink a lot of Coke.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some people drink a bucket of the stuff. So they're really messing with their metabolism way more than they might have thought. You know, then you ask a lot of people, how much do you think that Coke's affecting you? And they might, you know, put it, say, oh, 10% or something. But in actual fact, it can be a lot more than that.
I was really shocked when I found out that drinking Coca-Cola actually makes you more thirsty, that it strips more fluid out of your body than it supplies. So I guess it makes sense that if people are drinking a bit, they're going to drink a lot.
Well, yes, exactly, for that very reason. And people think that by eating, drinking the low-calorie version, that they won't get fat that way. But actually, it now turns out that the aspartame makes people fatter than the sugar did.
I remember hearing that one of the problems with all of these artificial sweeteners, and indeed generally the white comestibles, is that there's nothing left for the human system to kind of break down and process. There's nothing left in it, and that's why it takes it on board and stores it as fat. Is there any truth in that, do you think?
I think so, and I think one of the reasons that the body stores stuff in fat is that that's the only place it can put it if it can't get rid of it. I mean, you know, all natural foods, the body, if it doesn't like it, can get rid of it. You can throw up, you can sweat it out, you can breathe it out, you can crap it out, you know, lots of ways to get it out of your body. But if it's some chemical the body doesn't know how to excrete, then it's got to store it. So it doesn't want to store it in the brain or the bloodstream or the essential organs, so it'll store it in fat, just a good parking place.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people say to me, well, you know, I've tried every diet and I can't get rid of the belly fat, just won't go. Well, try a detox and find a new pathway that the body can get rid of those toxins, then the body can afford to let go of them. But, you know, fat is keeping a lot of people alive. Because if the body let go of the fat, then one would end up poisoning oneself.
Yeah. But detoxes can get rid of stuff that's stored that way in our fat tissue, can it?
Well, I mean, let me give you a couple of examples. Most people in this country are very low on sulfur, the mineral sulfur. And that's because there wasn't that much in the soil in England anyway, but beneath it stripped what there was out. So we're just not getting the sulfur that we should. Now, so let's say you ate some sulfur, assuming that the crops were grown on a sulfur-rich soil. There should be lots of sulfur in onions, lots of sulfur in garlic, lots of sulfur in broccoli and the other cruciferous vegetables. Now, so you could eat lots of those foods, which happen to be the top anti-cancer foods, by the way, just by coincidence, you might say. Or you could supplement with sulfur in various different ways. So what's special about sulfur? Well, if you've got heavy metals in your body, mercury from teeth and vaccines and the air, let's say your body isn't good at excreting mercury, so now it's building up in your cells and you could end up with dementia as a result of that. You could end up with a fungal infection as a result of that, various things that mercury do to change the body. But if you ingested sulfur, when the sulfur got into the cells and met up with the mercury, or any other metal for that matter, it would react with it and make mercury sulfate, or lead sulfate, or copper sulfate. And what's special about the sulfates as a group is they're water soluble. So you might have had that mercury, that lead, in your cells for decades. Suddenly you get enough sulfur, it turns water soluble, and you can pee it out for the first time in years.
And that disappears quite quickly, does it, using a process like that?
Well, it depends on a number of factors, but I wouldn't just do sulfur as a detox. I'd use zeolite, which is what they call a paramagnetic rock. It's actually molten lava, which flowed down the volcano, met a body of water, you know, a lake or the sea, and you can imagine a bubbling reaction of red-hot lava and water. You know, it's going to be a violent reaction, and that reaction causes this thing called zeolite, which has an interesting cellular structure. It's like a honeycomb, and it drags heavy metals like mercury and radiation and various toxins into it. In fact, it was what they, all around Europe, after the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, you probably saw those pictures maybe of the people who were paid a lot of money to go for 1 minute and shovel stuff on top of the roof of the reactor. That was zeolite. And some of the areas all around Chernobyl, the people were given zeolite to take with water. And the people who took the zeolite had a fraction of the health problems of everybody else because they were able to detox. So zeolite is an important detoxer.
That's amazing. That's amazing, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. In some areas, they gave iodine, Lugol's iodine and potassium iodide, huge anti-radiation. Your iodine and potassium iodide are very anti-radiation materials. And in the areas where they gave those materials, thyroid cancer, which was rampant around Chernobyl, didn't happen. Just didn't happen. So, you know, thyroid problems usually have a basis in an iodine deficiency.
That's quite incredible, isn't it? When you think about the the fear that's built up around nuclear radiation and contact and all of that. It is amazing that even for things like that, which have got a big capital F on the fear for them, have got relatively simple solutions that have been actually shown to work. That's the thing. You're saying that there's plenty of evidence from Chernobyl and I guess places like it that these techniques actually work.
Well, it can certainly help. A big nuclear accident like Chernobyl or the one in Japan, pretty serious. But what people don't realize about radiation and how it interacts with the body is, let's say that there's radioactive iodine floating around, which there is. If you have iodine receptors in your body that are empty, then there's somewhere for the radioactive iodine to go. But if you're replete in iodine, you've got enough iodine in your cells, then the radioactive iodine doesn't come into you because there's no receptors open for it. And this is the same with nutrition in general. If you have really great nutrition, all the minerals and vitamins and so on that you need, not only should you not get a virus, but you should be, to some degree, with certain of the radioactive materials, safe, because, you know, if, you know, cesium, all these things have somewhere specific they want to go in your body. But if you fill the gaps already, they just walk on by.
It's extraordinary that we have such a complex system to have kind of keys for all of these different things.
Well, we've got opiate receptors all over our body, particularly in the brain. We've got cannabis receptors all over our body, particularly in the brain. You know, it's amazing what we're wired up to take. But at the same time, you know, there are quite a few people who are moving from the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere because they're concerned about the radiation.
Yes. Well, in fact, they could be taking action where they are. And I mean, one way or the other, with so many nuclear power plants around the planet and with what is going on at Fukushima, I think it would behove us all to understand a bit about how it works.
Yeah, well, you know, plutonium, I don't know the answer to that one. And that's what, you know, some of them were fueled with, plutonium. So, you know, that's a difficult one.
And in terms of when you went to see your the expert, the man who's written so many books since, did he have a device that he used for diagnosing you, or did he simply look at the way your body was showing itself and read from that?
It was Patrick Holford, and no, he didn't use any equipment whatsoever. He asked me questions, and he could tell from my symptoms what was wrong. And, you know, that's why I do what I do now, because, you know, I can ask people telling questions and I can figure out what they're low on. I mean, I'll give you an example with iodine. The reason we're low on iodine is they're putting chlorine, bromine and fluoride in our water and in our products. You know, there are four halogens, bromine, chlorine, and fluoride are the bad guys, and iodine is the good guy. But the other three are smaller atomic sizes than iodine. So fluoride, bromine, and chlorine all fit in the iodine receptors because they're similar and smaller. And this is a really big issue because if you have a bath in chlorinated water, then you have a slice of bread that is made in a factory with a flour improver like bromine, and suddenly you're full of those halogens. And if you're low on iodine, they've got a place to go. And now, you know, you're getting dumbed down and getting brain damage from the fluoride. You know, they gave bromine to the soldiers in World War I so they didn't get horny. So it's not doing great things for your sex life and all your hormones. You know, the fluoride was first used in the gulags because they found they needed about a fifth of the guards, and then in the concentration camps they didn't need so many guards. And so as a result of that, everybody's got a thyroid problem. I mean, it's just insane. Then we're having a bath in chlorine, you know, which was the poison gas of choice in World War One. You know, we're putting ourselves in a small cubicle. We're getting hot, so our pores open in chlorine gas, fluoride gas, and in the liquid, it's going right into our bodies, crossing the blood-brain barrier, and now we've got brain damage. And the government are doing this to us, putting, you know, toxic waste, which is fluoride, into the water. And I read the original study, actually, of when they said fluoride is good for you and so on. I've read the whole study from start to finish, and it's such a fraud, it's ridiculous. It's a bunch of lies.
And it's clearly so, is it?
Sorry, say it again.
And it's clearly a bunch of lies, is it?
Oh, absolutely. Anybody reading it will discover this. It's totally rubbish. And So, but there are answers. And now, I wanted to say what the symptoms are. How do you know if you're low on iodine, okay? I'll give you a few of the symptoms. Doesn't mean you've got to have all of them, and there are others apart from the ones I'm about to mention. Chances are, if you're low on iodine, when you touch your elbows, the skin might be a tiny bit dry or very dry or a little bit rough. Your elbow, the skin of your elbow, should be as silky smooth as any other part of your arm. No dryness, roughness at all. So if you have dryness, roughness, you're low on iodine and you're in danger of having a thyroid issue. Now, another sign is temperature going all over the place. Some people may, compared to others, have really cold hands and feet. They might want to wear socks in bed, that sort of thing, not want to walk on a stone floor because it's sort of too much. Then there are people whose temperature is going the other way, really high, or just fluctuating ridiculously, particularly around menopause. It's part of the hormonal equation, so there are a number of hormonal problems that really relate to that. Some people find the outside of their eyebrows getting thin. Some people find they're not sweating. Some people find that their body hair is disappearing. There are a large number of symptoms for iodine deficiency, but the big one is having thyroid problems, both hyperthyroid, hypo and hyperthyroid. Both have an iodine deficiency linked to them. How many people are iodine deficient these days? I would suggest over 90%. In America, probably over 95%. So the answers are keep away from chlorine, keep away from fluoride, keep away from bromine. And I can explain how to do that, if you like.
Rick was rather on the button in the chat box there. He was asking what your stance was on fluoride, just as you were explaining it. And he was asking what can we do to combat its effect upon us? Because I think it might come as a surprise to some people that, of course, it's not just drinking water that's the problem, because our body in a hot bath's going to take a lot of it on, isn't it?
It's a serious issue. You're getting more in the bath than you would be drinking, probably. But it's easy in the bath. You can buy for, I don't know, 10 quid a kilo or less, borax. Borax is what our ancestors at one point commonly washed their clothes with. You put a teaspoonful or so of borax in the bath, it will neutralize the chlorine bump. It'll neutralize the fluoride.
Yeah.
Borax or boron, same thing, neutralize fluoride. So if you put a pinch of fluoride in a liter of drinking water, again, that would neutralize the fluoride. And it may have the advantage that of staving off arthritis, because lack of boron, the mineral boron, can be one of the causes of arthritis. And how I know that is that a guy called Dr. Rex Newnham, he was a soil biologist in England, and he changes jobs and takes a job in Australia. And within a short time, months, he's developing arthritis. And being a biologist, he realizes it must be something about what he's eating. It must be a mineral deficiency. That's what he worked out. And he studied it, and he realized very quickly that the country with the highest rate of arthritis in the world happened to have the lowest rate of boron in the soil in the world, and the country with the lowest rate of arthritis had the highest rate of boron in the soil. Those two countries, interestingly, the country with the most arthritis in the world, and this may surprise people, is Jamaica, because they have the lowest boron because the sugar plantation stripped the boron out of the soil.
Right.
And the one with the highest, the lowest amount of arthritis is Israel. And if anybody knows anybody who lives in Israel, try asking them, do you know anybody with arthritis? And they'll say, probably they'll say no. Mm. Whereas in England, everybody knows somebody with arthritis.
Yeah. And that's what you're suggesting there are tiny additions of very cheap commodities to the bath to make it safe.
And if you want to make it safe from chlorine, put in a teaspoonful or two of vitamin C powder, like ascorbic acid. That will instantly neutralize the chlorine, or one could get a filter, which would be sensible way to do it if you can afford it.
Yes, I do know some people whose whole houses are actually filtered, so they're showering and bathing in clean water as well. You've got quite a lot of good recommendations of things to put into baths, haven't you? Because one of the first things you talked to me about, and one of the first things we talked about this evening as well, was magnesium, and you can put magnesium flakes in your bath?
Well, you can indeed, and of course people have been doing it for millennia. You know, all the... Yeah, when you used to go to the Roman baths, the spa baths, you know, people used to go, if they had aching limbs, they'd go for a week's holiday or 2 weeks' holiday to one of the spas, hang out in the waters, take the waters, it was called, and they get better. There are two types of baths that people go for. Some go for the sulfur baths, they're usually hot and outside. But the majority of the famous spa towns like Baden-Baden and Bath and so on, it's because in places like Baden-Baden, they have magnesium-rich waters. That was the benefit. It's like the sea. The sea is full of magnesium. The Dead Sea, incredibly concentrated magnesium. That's why Dead Sea salts work so well. But you have to put maybe up to a kilo in a bath to make it work. Just putting a handful in will not work. It's not concentrated enough. You have to put a lot in the bath, say 3/4 of a kilo or something like that, mm-hmm. and you want to have it as hot as you like, hotter the better, and stay there for as long as possible, 25 minutes or something, if you can do it for that long. And I have magnesium baths often because being type 1 diabetic, if I'm not careful, I can get high blood pressure. And the best thing I've discovered to get my blood pressure down is to have a magnesium bath.
Mm-hmm.
It's very calming. Very calming. You know, things that, because one of the symptoms of magnesium deficiency is anxiety, panic attacks. And so, you know, if life is becoming anxious for you, either have a magnesium bath or spray magnesium on straight on the body as magnesium chloride and have a bath in magnesium chloride. If you spray it on, it's cheaper because you need so much less of it. But I've had people who said, look, I've had the best night's sleep I've had for 20 years after using a lot of magnesium. If you take it internally, if you take any meaningful amount, you just get diarrhea. But if you apply it through the skin, which, of course, is the body's biggest organ, then you can take infinite amounts without upsetting the bowels. So spraying it on, bathing it, that's the way forward.
Yeah, just goes to show how effective bath water can be as a means of transmission through the skin, doesn't it?
And if you were to put another type of magnesium, magnesium sulfate, which is Epsom salts, into the bath, and people have been taking Epsom salts bath for as long as anybody knows, because Epsom salts just occur, there are mines which are just Epsom salts. It's a naturally occurring mineral compound. And the interesting thing about Epsom salts, which is different to the magnesium chloride, like the Dead Sea, is, let's say, you get those splinters that you can't get out?
Yeah.
You
know,
it's in there, it may have been in there for a couple of days now, and it's beginning to get infected, it's beginning to get nasty, but you, no matter how much you poke it with needles and stuff, it won't come out. If you make a paste, some Epsom salts and a few drops of water, make a paste, put it on top of the splinter, wait 10 minutes, and squeeze, it'll come right out.
That's a very useful tip, that is.
So if you have a bath in Epsom salts, poisons and stuff that's in the body, it enables another detox pathway.
And that's another very cheap solution, isn't it? Because Epsom salts are readily available and inexpensive. How much did you say you have to put in a bath?
Well, it depends on the size of your bath, but
yeah.
Anything less than 0.5 kilo is probably a waste of time. So to be on the safe side, 3/4 of a kilo, a kilo, I generally chuck in a kilo. Again, it depends how long you're going to stay in it, but there is a factor of it doesn't work until the concentration is high enough, and then suddenly it will work. So you've got to put in quite a lot.
Okay.
If you're on a real budget, you could do it with a foot bath. So you could use much less because you haven't now got such a concentrated solution, and just stick your foot in it for a couple of hours or something, your feet in it.
Yeah.
And again, foot baths used to be really popular things.
One of my favourite encounters was with a detoxing foot bath, which I think you have a light saline solution which has a small current pass through it. And, I mean, I don't know what was going on, but certainly when I had a go with it, the water around my feet turned absolutely black. I watched somebody else who led a slightly cleaner lifestyle than me, and she got a kind of golden water around her. So, have you come across those? Is that actually... I mean, if it is pulling toxins out, it pulled a lot out of me, for sure.
Yes. Assuming you've got a machine that's sort of real and proper... Because like almost like so many things in this world, people make fakes, machines that look like it but are fake. But anyway, there are some really good ones. Funny enough, this woman rang me up just last week, and we were talking about various things. And then suddenly she said, "Look, I'm going to tell you the truth. I'm the woman who kidnapped their child from the hospital." And she was American. She was known in the press as the something woman. It'll come to me in a minute. Anyway, her child had been kidnapped by the medical profession. She decided no, she didn't want the medical profession to give her young child drugs. And they said, "We're going to. There's nothing you can do." And so she kidnapped her child and cured the child with a foot bath. Cured it exactly the machines you're describing. Cured the child with a foot bath. And because she kidnapped her baby, she was vilified, and eventually they caught her and threw her in jail, separated her from the child, threw her in jail.
Gosh, shocking. Shocking, isn't it? And I mean, I gather the medical profession is imposing itself on parents via their children.
Well, if you sign, there's like a vaccine release document, in America, this is doing the rounds, where the parents are told, "Well, if you don't want your child to have the vaccine, sign this document." So they sign the document, and at which point the authorities then can say, "Well, you've signed the document saying no to the vaccine. You're clearly not a fit parent, and we're going to take your child away."
So by signing the document, they've somehow handed over jurisdiction.
Absolutely. They shouldn't have signed anything. They just said no. They signed this piece of paper, which is then turned against them.
Yeah. Yes, generally a bit of a mistake to hand over the signature, I think. Paul in the chat box has asked, he's put, "Can you ask Clive the best way to take MMS, and can it be used on skin cancer?"
The best thing to do is to look at the work of... Andreas Kalka of Kerry Rivera and the people who work with MMS. Although I've taken it myself, I would only use it as a last resort. But so many autistic children have recovered with MMS. It's the most amazing. Probably 100,000 people by now have recovered from malaria. It is an amazing thing, but I would use it rectally. Although I did an interview with Kerry Rivera just 2 weeks ago. If anybody goes onto YouTube and puts in my name, Clive DeCarl, and Kerry Rivera, she explains how she uses it to get the autistic children to lose the symptoms of autism, and she gets to take it orally and rectally.
And she seems to be getting very good. Quite demonstrable results, but she's been given a very hard time by orthodoxy, isn't she?
Well, she doesn't live in America anymore, and you wouldn't. So, with 15 doctors now murdered, supposedly murdered, all to do with vaccines and curing cancer and so on.
Murdered. I hadn't been keeping up on that.
Well, with Dr. Jeffrey Bradstreet, who was the most vociferous of the autism doctors, medical doctor, he was the one who used to stand up in court and say to the judge, it was the vaccines that caused this child's autism, and here's the proof. So he wasn't popular for that. Then he was the first, one of the first people to publicly say that although everybody knows that vaccines cause autism, you can equally say that vaccines don't cause autism, and I'll explain what I mean in a moment. But in Cuba, they have a very similar rate of, you know, nasty vaccines as England or America has, but their rate of autism hasn't risen.
Ah.
Right, and they have 99% compliance because of the communist regime. For whatever reason, they can achieve 99% of Cubans are vaccinated. So that's amazing compliance, much better than any other country. And when they started, you know, the MMR vaccine, all the other nasty ones that we believed caused autism, they had no rise. So it's not the vaccines, or at least it's not the vaccines alone. So what is it? Well, in Cuba, they don't have paracetamol available at the chemists. The doctors don't prescribe paracetamol. So what happens in the rest of the world? The child gets some sort of inflammation, some sort of reaction to the vaccine, you know, rise in temperature. So the mother, wanting the best they can for the child, decides to give them a painkiller. Might give them aspirin, might give them Nurofen, might give them paracetamol. Now, if they give them aspirin and Nurofen, they would have been fine. It's the ones that got the paracetamol and the vaccine that became autistic. You have to have both of those together to get autism. So Dr. Bradstreet was talking about this. So, and he was also, on top of that, recommending GC-MAF. And so what happened was the FDA raided his place, and one day later, he apparently shot himself with a shotgun and then climbed over a bridge and threw himself off. And he wasn't the first one within a period of weeks to get raided by the FDA and kill themselves the next day, supposedly kill themselves. But you can't shoot yourself with a shotgun, I don't think, and then...
Throw yourself off a bridge.
No. So it seems that they've deliberately done these things in a sloppy manner as a sort of look-what-we-can-do-and-scare-people thing.
Yeah. I wonder if that'll work in the long run, because the certainly the autism story is a very long-running story, and it does... We do seem to keep getting further evidence that there is this link between vaccines and autism. It's interesting that the business with the paracetamol, because that would have made it a lot harder to pin down.
It's a whole country. The thing is, the proof is an entire country. They can't deny it because Cuba is there, the big smoking gun.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know what's happened to Dr. Wakefield? Did he ever manage to get himself... redeemed, as it were?
He's fine. He's working openly in America. And, I think probably because he's had so much publicity, if they bumped him off, it would all be way too obvious.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm just checking through. We had another couple of questions in the chat box, and then perhaps I'll have a music break, if that's okay. You okay with us, Carl? Clive?
Yeah, absolutely.
Very good. Rick asked, what do you know of high aluminium content in foods?
High what content?
Aluminium content.
Aluminium?
Yeah.
I don't really know much about it. They tend to put aluminium in with some bicarbonate of sodas occasionally. You certainly don't want aluminium, and... As we mentioned before, all those chelating agents like sulfur, I didn't mention the others, fulvic minerals would help draw out heavy metals. Salt, real grey, wet Celtic salt, real unprocessed salt, is a good detoxifier as well. Iodine's a good detoxifier.
I've been using that grey salt since you recommended. We got some of it from ancientpurity.com, and it's really nice salt, actually. It works really well for cooking, and I have it in my water in the morning. And it actually makes the water taste quite sweet. It's completely different to the salt I'm used to having.
Celtic salt is my favourite, or pretty much of all the supplements you can buy. It's the cheapest. It makes food taste incredible. It makes, as you say, water. It makes the water soft, and so it's much more drinkable, much easier to drink. And if you've got salt in the water, real balanced salt, it opens up the cells and hydrates the cells, because you know you can irrigate your body with water, or you can hydrate it by getting it into the cells. So, you know, the more salt you have in the water, if it's proper salt, the better it is from a hydration point of view.
And is it good to have just a pinch of this stuff in each of the pints of water that you drink? It's not doing you any harm, that, is it?
No, because, you know, the salt they warned us about is the table salt and processed salt, like regular sea salt, where they've taken the water-loving minerals out, like magnesium. You don't want to have any of that, let alone too much, really. But real balanced salt, it just balances you out. You know, high blood pressure gets lowered, low blood pressure gets raised. You know, it's a balancer. You know, in fact, in World War II, when the Navy ran out of blood plasma, they used seawater.
Yes, I heard that. I heard that. That's it's quite astonishing, really. And salt's such an important part of everything. I mean, one of the things I've been looking at is trying to reduce salt and sugar. And actually, when certainly in a lot of supermarkets, and certainly in like petrol station forecourt shops, all there seems to be is salt and sugar, and none of it's actual salt.
Well, when I became diabetic 30 years ago, that the first thing the doctors advised me, they said, now you're diabetic, you're going to have to cut right down on salt. So for the next 10 years, cutting down on salt, I got for the first time in my life muscle cramps, because I'd cut down on the salt so much I wasn't getting enough magnesium anymore. So for 10 years I was getting muscle cramps. It was only when somebody said, oh, you realize those muscle cramps is because you're not eating enough magnesium in salt, I started ignoring the stupid advice that the doctors gave me, and started eating salt, and the muscle cramps went away.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. You're insulin-dependent diabetes. Are you managing to make any... Do you think you'll ever manage to see that off, or are you just managing to limit its effects with your knowledge?
Well, if I was very strict with my diet, stricter than I'm willing to be, because I love food too much to be that strict, I'd have to cut out all carbohydrates. I'd have to survive on green leaves, a few nuts and seeds, and maybe a very small amount of berries and mushrooms. But it would be almost impossible for me to live, but I could probably technically probably become not type 1 diabetic, but life would barely be worth living. But I am sure that within a reasonably short space of time, one will be able to restart the pancreas. And there are a lot of reasons why that's the case. At a very coarse level, there's the incredible work being done by Dr. Atala in America, who's growing body parts. You give him your DNA, and you say, I want a new bladder. He'll build you a new bladder out of your own DNA, so that there's stem cells, rather. So you don't reject it, because it's been made from your own parts. For 10 years now, he's been making things like heart valves. He grows a beating heart valve in a test tube from your cells. It's unbelievable.
Blimey, is he the only guy doing that?
No, there are others doing it. He's the most famous. His name's spelled Atala. Put Dr. Atala into YouTube, and you'll see his beating heart valves. It's incredible. People don't know, but you can grow your own body parts. So I'm hopeful he's doing hearts. He's making hearts and he's printing them out on a printer, like an inkjet printer. When he first started, he took the ink out, put stem cells in, and adapted the inkjet printer, and he started printing body parts layer by layer.
Wow, that is truly one of the most astonishing things I've heard for a while.
Yeah. So there's a CNN film that I saw about 8 years ago called Regrowing Body Parts. You know, CNN, big 15-minute serious, you know, outfit. So he's been on TED Talks, and he's quite well known.
So it means that technically speaking, you no longer have to take the organs from almost still living human being to get somebody else alive. You could actually start making them and get rid of.
Yes, and this is happening now, organ by organ. And you're absolutely right. I mean, anybody who's got an organ donor card needs to reverse it immediately, because people don't realise that you're still alive. You're not given anaesthetic. You're given a paralytic drug, and they take out your organs while you're completely alive. They've given you a brain dead. Told you he's brain dead, but it's a totally arbitrary decision. And we know from people who've come back, they're not brain dead. They feel everything. They know when you're cutting their kidneys out.
Yeah,
they're fully aware of it.
And amazingly, some characteristics seem to travel with the organs sometimes as well.
Not just with the organ, but with blood transfusions, more commonly with the organs, but it's not occasionally with the organs, apparently, I'm told, it's every time.
Every time?
I'm told, particularly with hearts. You know, suddenly the person starts liking the things that the previous owner of the organ liked. United or something.
Yeah, or sometimes this can be quite serious. I read about a lass who woke up, and she had been a vegetarian, but she had an overwhelming urge for chicken nuggets and Coca-Cola, having had a transplant, which must have been a bit shocking. Well, look, I'll tell you what, Clive, we've been chatting for an hour or so. I've got another couple of questions in the chat box, but we'll come back to them after a bit of music, if that's all right with you. I'll put sort of seven or 8 minutes on.
Perfect.
Excellent stuff. Thank you very much. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on peoplesinternetradio.com, where I'm chatting with Clive DeCarle, and fascinating it is too. So here comes Flogging Molly, Rebels of the Sacred Heart. I know I played it a few weeks back, but I think it's really great. So here it is again. We'll be back with you in 7 or 8 minutes. There you go. That was Let the Jury Sing from the Mad Apple Circus, and you're now joining us live again, the conversation with Clive DeCarle about optimising our performance through detoxifying and re-nutrifying ourselves. Thanks for joining us again, Clive.
My pleasure.
We had a couple of questions hanging over from the chat box before we went to a music break. The first was concerning diatomaceous earth and whether you've got any comments on that.
I like diatomaceous earth. I think it's a very useful material. I use it if the cats get fleas, for example. It's sort of natural pesticide, an organic pest control mechanism.
Oh, I didn't know that. I know several people who are seeking methods of dealing with fleas. What do you do with the earth and the cat?
It comes with a very fine powder, and you sort of just rub it into the fur. And, cats don't like it one bit. But I had one kitten who liked it so much that it would actually lick the stuff and eat it. There might have been a natural, reaction, because it might have had worms or whatever it might be. So some cats don't like it being rubbed in their skin, but some of them actually deliberately choose to eat it, because it is, as well as killing worms and stuff like that, it is very nutritious. And it's full of silica, and silica's good for the hair and the nails and things. Other things that have got silica in it are nettles, horsetail, the herb. Why nettles are so good for you, partly, is because of all the silica. And it's good for the heart. It's a brilliant material, actually. And you can use it as a sort of colon cleanser.
How do you use it for that?
Mix it with water and drink it. Put a teaspoonful up to a tablespoonful in a glass of water, stir it up, drink it, and it removes you know, all sorts of organisms in your intestines that you wouldn't normally want there.
I remember reading about some parrots in Jeremy Narby's book, Intelligence in Nature, and a bunch of Amazonian rainforest parrots that ate a kind of clay that none of the other parrots ate. And as a result, their systems apparently detoxified themselves better and enabled them to eat seeds that were not accessible to other parrots.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, certainly diatomaceous earth has a lot of properties. I mean, it's another thing that removes toxic heavy metals. You know, you drink a solution with diatomaceous earth in, it's going to rip those heavy metals out. It's great.
Mm. And do you have to do that daily, do you?
No. No, one might choose to for a time. But, you know, these are the things people need to research themselves.
Yes. You know? I guess most of these remedies are like that, aren't they? It's not like you have to use them all the time. You go onto them for a while and then off them and onto something else. Nothing's too good all the time, is it?
You do it until the problem is solved.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, with any good remedy, you hope to notice it because, you know, it's either you're suddenly feeling a lot better or, you know, your body's working better, you're feeling stronger, whatever it is. You know, that's the idea that you notice.
Yes, yeah. There's a question about what looks to me to be a related question anyway about fulvic minerals. Graham, the artist formerly known as Graham, has asked, can you ask Clive if he has had any problems with fulvic minerals? My last batch smelt strange, was not clear, and the teabag test, Clive shows, only worked partly. Just wondering, he said, what's the teabag test?
Yeah, well, I put out a video a few years ago where I added fulvic to a tea bag, a green tea bag, and a cold glass of water. And, you know, it's like you put green tea bag in cold water, nothing happens. And you add the fulvic, and then you dunk the tea bag a bit, and all the tea comes out at once. In fact, it just goes black. And so at that point, I was saying that this is a great test for fulvic. Anyway, then the manufacturer of the fulvic we use said, I found a new way to extract it. It's totally different. Try it. So one of the first things I did was the teabag test, and it worked, but not as dramatically as the previous extraction had. And I, just like this guy, was concerned, well, maybe this one isn't as good as the last one. But the mineral assay showed that it had twice the fulvic content. And on the one hand, I was thinking, oh, I don't know, it's not doing the teabag test as well. I was convinced by the mineral assay, so we went with it and sat back and waited to see what people thought. Now, a couple of people have said they don't like it as much as the original, but the vast majority say they like it more. And fulvic is one of those supplements that people often notice. You know, loads of supplements, people don't notice any difference at all. With fulvic, a surprising number of people say, wow, I feel so much stronger, faster, fitter, whatever it is. So at the moment, yes, it doesn't seem to do the green tea test as well, but people seem to like it more. So,
and that's another detoxing element, is it, for use internally?
Absolutely. Detoxes, but more importantly, probably, fulvic minerals gives you the trace elements. So, you know, you could buy a multi-mineral in the shops and it could have 20 minerals in it, but does it have every single mineral? You know, there are over 70, and fulvic minerals has the lot. It's not to say that fulvic minerals are the only mineral supplement you need. You take the fulvic minerals for the trace elements, and then for the larger elements, ones you want more physical quantity, like magnesium, potassium, you either take as foods, or as we mentioned earlier with magnesium, you use the ideally the transdermal skin version of the magnesium.
Now, we've noticed that stings quite a lot when you start using it and seems to sting less with time. Is that usual? The magnesium, well, that is, the spray-on magnesium.
The reason it stings at the beginning for some people, not everybody, and then stings less over a few days, is because if you're very low on magnesium, dangerously low, it stings when you use it. And that's a sign that somebody's very low.
Right. Well, that's useful to know.
And what you can do is dilute it with water for the first week or so to half strength or something, and then it probably won't sting, then build up to full strength.
I quite enjoy the stinging.
Well, it shows it's doing something.
Yeah, then, yeah.
The interesting thing about the minerals, you know, let's say sodium or potassium or magnesium, you know, on the one hand, we think of them as these little, you know, bits of nutrition that don't do anything. But bearing in mind that our bodies are mainly water, what happens when you add sodium to water? So I've got, just as a party trick, some lumps of sodium. And if I throw them into a bucket of water, what will happen? If I put some sodium in water, it will explode into flames and make a loud bang. So imagine what happens when you put sodium in your body. Does it explode in flames and give a loud bang? No. Well, you're not eating that much of it. What about potassium? When you add that to water, it explodes into flames. What about magnesium? Well, you set fire to pure magnesium and it burns with the brightest white light. Yeah, we're talking about powerful things, minerals.
Yeah, I remember all of those experiments from school, actually. It's we're like a walking chemistry set, aren't we?
Well, we are. But, you know, people don't realise when they're spraying magnesium on just how powerful that material is.
Mm. So our basic means of diagnosis here is really our own symptoms, isn't it? Is looking at our own body and using that as the means by which we assess what's going on.
Well, that's one of the ways. I mean, let's say you asked a doctor about your magnesium levels. Well, because they're not taught about magnesium, probably they'd do a blood test. That would be a typical thing a doctor would do, a blood test. But, of course, actually, the magnesium that's important in your body isn't in the blood. It's in the cells. So, you know, what the doctor should do is order a cellular magnesium test, intracellular. But they'd only do that if they were taught about it, which they're not. So an intracellular magnesium test would be an effective way to see if you're low. But with magnesium, the symptoms are so obvious that you can do it on symptoms alone very, very confidently. So the symptoms of low magnesium would include, and you don't have to have the whole lot, and there are others apart from the ones I'll mention, but the primary ones, apart from anxiety and panic attacks, could be restless leg, could be cramps, menstrual cramps, muscle cramps, foot cramps. And if you've got a cramp of your heart, that would be called a heart attack. If you've got constipation, that's probably either a dehydration or a magnesium deficiency, very likely, because magnesium allows muscles to relax. So if you can't relax your muscles, you can get a cramp. And if you get a cramp for a woman in their menstrual cycle, that's very painful. If you get a cramp as a woman when you're giving birth, you could have preeclampsia, the solution to which, the emergency solution, is to inject magnesium. If you're having a heart attack, the emergency solution, which the emergency surgeons know about, is magnesium. If you're having a stroke and you're rushed into the emergency room, they give you magnesium. They don't teach doctors magnesium because that would cure everything. That would be no good.
Yeah. And yet the fact that that's what you get when you turn up shows that that there is a level of knowledge in there somewhere. It's just being applied, perhaps, a bit inappropriately.
They only share that information about magnesium to the emergency room doctors because they need to know, but the GPs don't need to know, so they don't tell them.
Astonishing, really.
Well, you've got to remember the money that's involved.
Yeah. Now,
a round of chemotherapy is about up to £40,000. Some people have up to 15 or more rounds. That's, you know, maybe £800,000. That's a lot of money compared to magnesium.
Well, I remember it might even have been in one of your vids somewhere, actually seeing the suggestion that in many circumstances the juice of a lemon can do as much good as the chemo.
Well, and there's lots of actual evidence proving it. You know, it's not just me saying it.
Which is quite astonishing, because organic lemons are expensive, but they're not as expensive as chemo.
But better than lemons, in a lot of cases, and the most researched of all the herbs, spices, whatever, is turmeric.
Yes.
Particularly in the form of curcumin, which is the extract. Now, if you mix together black pepper and turmeric or curcumin, it makes it over 10 times as powerful. I've heard even higher than that. You can reverse all sorts of quite difficult issues using curcumin turmeric. It's amazing.
This is really one of the astonishing things that I've, you know, over the years been working my way towards understanding, is that there do seem to be some things that are incredibly simple, incredibly cheap, and incredibly effective. Drinking water with lemon juice in is one, drinking water with turmeric in is another, and drinking water with apple cider vinegar is another. All of these things seem to be, if they're done, I mean, not necessarily every day, but reasonably regularly, give you a good chance of avoiding many of the problems that are extremely common, it would appear, in modern Western life. I mean, are all of those sort of valid approaches?
Well, the solutions are really simple, generally. Salt is such a big one. Hydration, as you say, water is such a big one. It's really pretty simple. But salt is so important. You know, the benefits of Celtic salt just can't be stressed enough. You know, if you weren't worth your salt in the old days, you died.
Well, we really need salts, don't we? And I mean, making sure that we get, in effect, what's happening, it occurred to me when I was reading about the nature of the table salt, sodium chloride, whatever it's properly known as, it occurred to me that whilst it is totally crucial to all of our electrical processes, we're basically made out of salt water, people aren't getting any salt if they're not getting the Celtic sea salt. So most of us must be deprived to a large extent of one of the critical elements that goes to make us up.
Well, absolutely. So how to rectify it? Well, spend £6 wisely, and you've got several months' supply of Celtic salt.
And your food really will taste better. It really will. I mean, we really love the Celtic sea salt. I haven't yet picked up my packet of essentials from Ancient Purity. I'm going to get them tomorrow, but I know there's fulvic minerals in there and some of the salt. There's vitamin C, there's more of the magnesium spray. What else have you chosen to put in there?
Well, there's iodine, there's the magnesium, there's sulfur, zeolite, vitamin D, yeah, everything you could possibly need, really. It's not a cheap package. But being ill can be a very expensive business. Although I was one of the founders of Ancient Purity, now it's owned by my partner, ex-partner Tom, who's doing a very good job, so I don't actually run it anymore. But if people hearing this would like to buy some Ancient Purity products, if they click through my website and order it, I just get a very small commission, which keeps me employed. And my website is clivedecarle.com. They'll also see a link there to another site I've got called the Secret Health Club.
That's a very interesting idea, the Secret Health Club. What prompted you to set that up, and what advantages do you hope to that will accrue to people from it?
Well, there are a number of factors to it. I suppose the original idea was that if you have a club, you should be able to say things that you can't say in public. I mean, you know, look at, you know, all the clubs you can join. You know, at the far extreme, there'd be sex clubs. There's stuff you can do in a private club situation that you could never do in any other situation legally.
Look what they're doing in the Houses of Parliament.
I mean, you know, then there's what's the difference between a club and a society? And people who join the Secret Health Club actually are joining a different society. So, you know, the law society has its rules. Mr. Cameron's big society supposedly has its rules. But you can join a club which has within it a society which has different rules. Rules like, we're going to tell the truth. Your laws don't apply. That sort of thing. But, I mean, it's a specious notion. It's whether, you know, courts, as we know, are corrupt. So,
well, that's great. So, basically, it's at last the secret society that I can join.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And one, a club that would actually have you.
Yeah, there's not too many of those around.
Right. And and I thought also it was quite a good marketing gimmick, to be honest.
Yes. Yeah, well, I certainly like the look of it, and I mean, given the amount of stuff there is arriving in my inbox every day, it'd be great to know that the stuff that's coming in is quality and useful.
So, but the really good bit about the Secret Health Club, actually, is the fact that I've bought 4 frequency devices which work on various principles, including bioresonance and Rife. Lots and lots of different principles that it works on, and I can broadcast through somebody's DNA frequencies that will make them feel happier, more relaxed, more comfortable, and weller, healthier. And so when I say a DNA sample, then anything would do, but preferably a fingernail. Fingernails are an ideal sample, and this is Tesla technology, you know. Over 100-year-old Tesla technology combined with Rife technology, combined with modern-day understanding of quantum physics and scalar waves. So it's a scalar wave device, and so I can broadcast instantly frequencies across the globe to anybody that I've put in the transmitter, anybody's DNA I put in the transmitter. So when people join the Secret Health Club, they can send me samples of their DNA, fingernails, and I can send them eye healing frequencies. I can send them the frequencies, 528, for instance, the love frequency. I can send the GC Math frequency. There are a whole host of frequencies. I've got one generator which is purely for sleep. So people who are within the English time zone of sleeping can find their sleep perhaps improved by me sending them sleep frequencies. It's really very interesting technology, and there are lots of people around the world using this now, and it's super effective, quite surprising.
It's completely amazing that, you know, I think in the old days they might have called that witchcraft.
Well, yes, but I mean, you know, Einstein recognized what we're talking about. He called it spooky action at a distance because it was spooky. He couldn't figure, he knew it was happening. You know, he knew that time on the one hand was real, but on the other hand, I mean, there's more than one type of time. Einstein, by the way, said everything is everything in the world is vibration. Everything is frequency, which is absolutely true. So how this technology works is that everything has a frequency. You know, every parasite has its own frequency. Every mold, every bacteria, every virus has its own frequency. Magnesium has its own frequency. Every organ of the body has its own frequency. So let's say that somebody's got a parasite. Okay, with this technology, you can dial up the frequency of that parasite, broadcast it, and just like an opera singer, if they hit the note, let's say that they're singing and they hit the frequency of a crystal glass, an opera singer can smash the glass with the resonant frequency. They hit exactly the same frequency of the glass, and the glass shatters. And similarly, you hit the frequency of the parasite will shatter. So one of the things I don't do with this device is broadcast any destructive frequencies like that, anything that could lead to a detoxification, because if you killed too many parasites and you were very, very weak, that might be unpleasant.
Yeah, so, you could end up with quite a severe healing reaction, couldn't you?
Exactly. So the only frequencies we broadcast are the ones that have no deep detoxification effects. But that includes eyesight improvement. It's a number of quite beneficial things.
That sounds really amazing. So many of the things you talk about, I'm really interested in investigating further. I'll have to have a look at the Secret Health Club. And I remember hearing that it had been discovered, for example, that the frequency signature of mistletoe seemed to be particularly effective with some forms of cancer, and that frequency had been recorded, attached to an email, and then sent to the other side of the world, where the frequency was played to a glass of water, and the result was as if physical mistletoe had been added to the water. And that shows, I think, a pretty sound basis for the kind of technologies that you're talking about.
Well, and of course it's also the explanation of why and how homeopathy has worked for the last 200 years.
I love homeopathy.
Well, you know, the Queen uses homeopathy for all her racehorses. She doesn't use vets, she uses homeopathy. Do her racehorses win? Yes, they do.
I say, if it works on horses, it's a very difficult thing to argue against, isn't it?
Not only that, but again, Cuba did the biggest ever homeopathy experiment. Something like 1.3 million people took part. There's an area of Cuba that after the rainy season, there's this particularly nasty disease that a lot of people get, tens of thousands. And one year, they gave 1.3 million people a homeopathic, not a remedy, but something to make them resistant against this disease. And, I mean, you don't get bigger samples than 1.3 million people. And there was a dramatic reduction in the disease levels for the people who took the homeopathic vaccine.
That is fabulous, isn't it? I mean, Cuba, really, say what you like about it, it has done some pretty interesting investigations in its time. And it's still, I mean, how much longer can we go on successfully keeping secret stuff which has been so apparent for so long? It almost defies imagination that all of this stuff is still somehow not publicly acceptable.
Well, you know, people are waking up, aren't they?
They certainly are. It's my feeling that the more difficult the NHS gets to be to deal with when you can access it, and the more difficult it gets to access, then the more people there are going to be investigating these, well, we'll call them alternative approaches. They are actually the real approaches, I think, really. But in a way, you can see that the challenges we're facing are actually generating people's interest in the solutions, I would hope. I mean, I don't know whether you're seeing yourself getting busier as the years go by, are you?
Not much, no. But you see, we're in this weird one country in the world where healthcare supposedly is free. Yeah, we get free drugs. But in America, for instance, if you've got cancer and you've got to pay $40,000 for each round of chemo, you've got a lot of incentive because it's a choice of the house and you might survive or not, or you don't get the chemo. So people are selling their houses to be killed by chemo. Something like 60% of all Americans are taking health supplements because it's so much cheaper than going to a doctor. You know, here people just go to the doctor because it's free.
So in America, they're actually learning that it's better to stay healthy in the first place.
Well, maybe, but they're much more awake there because they have to be, because a lot of people haven't got a house to sell.
And they haven't effectively handed their responsibility to somebody else.
Yep.
Formerly known as Graham's come up with another question. He's asking, can you ask Clive if nano silver at 10 parts per million is more effective against parasites and viruses than ordinary colloidal silver at 20 parts per million?
Well, in my book, normal colloidal silver is 10 parts per million. But if you had 5 parts per million, that would be even better because it's smaller. But 10 parts per million seems to work just fine. Mm-hmm. But watch out for what is being touted as nano silver, which is way smaller than that. Something really bizarre happened about 5-6 years ago. At that point, before I realized it was way too depressing, and I made the mistake of watching Alex Jones for a while, not realizing who he really was. And at that point, this must have been, I don't know, 7 years ago or something, the sponsor for Alex Jones's show was a colloidal silver manufacturer, Len Horowitz. And Len apparently was overnight, he suddenly found he wasn't the sponsor for the Alex Jones show, and there was a new one. So he wasn't giving any warning. So he rings up, and the producers say, "Oh yeah, we've changed to another colloidal silver generator as the sponsor, who are now making something called nano silver." Anyway, I felt sorry for Len, but I was making colloidal silver, selling it myself at that point. So I got the patent out, and I discovered that this was the first silver that had ever been granted any status by the FDA. The FDA had not sanctioned any.
Oh, it must be all right then.
Well, yeah. So I got the patent out, 110 pages or whatever it was, and read right the way through it, and it told me exactly how it was different, how they'd made it, and so on. But the first thing I couldn't help but notice when I got the patent out was who owned it. These people are the sponsors of the Alex Jones show. The patent was jointly owned by the American government and the Department of Homeland Security.
There you go. Picked up on something that works, make it something that doesn't work, and make that popular.
Well, yeah. You know, it's you know, the issue is what else they're putting in it.
Yeah. Yeah, taking a really useful thing and making it not only not useful, but potentially dangerous.
Well, the interesting thing is it still works, their version, but I just don't believe that they would do anything that's good for you. There's something not right.
Certainly the evidence would suggest and precedent would suggest that doing things that are good for us is not standard operating procedure.
Well, you know, basically, people need to know who they're buying their products from. Do you know who owns Holland & Barrett?
Isn't it Unilever or somebody like that now, isn't it?
The people who own them are owned by the Carlyle Group. Ooh. The Carlyle Group, of course, is John Major & Co., biggest arms dealer manufacturers around. Very nasty bunch.
Yeah.
So people are going to arms dealers expecting that they're going to the right people to look after their health.
And I guess when we're talking about parasites and viruses, wouldn't you perhaps be going for the vitamin C rather than the nanosilver anyway?
Well, vitamin C, of course, will overcome any virus, all viruses. But, you know, there's always several things that will do the trick. But most people have got scurvy and don't know it. Almost everybody's low on vitamin C, I would think. Me included, unless I pay attention.
Yeah, and that's amazing again, isn't it, really? Because scurvy's thing we're celebrating as having been got rid of in the old naval days using, I don't know, sometimes fermented foods, sometimes limes. And yet it appears to be pretty rife, doesn't it, in modern society? I know that when we had our chat, you were saying that that's at the root, if you excuse the pun, that's at the root of my tooth problems, is a lack of vitamin C.
Certainly, all viruses can be cured with vitamin C, essentially. Most bacterial infections can, but with teeth, the most important tooth factors, I would suggest, include vitamin D, which is, you know, sunshine, oils. If you're eating healthy oils, particularly unpasteurized butter, your teeth are going to be great.
Yes, unpasteurized butter is quite difficult to come across. We have been making it and eating it for the last year or so. I've taken to using the organic coconut oil.
Well, yeah, that's good too. You can buy unpasteurized butter in Waitrose.
Can you? I'll have to take a quick trip to Abergavenny. But that, yeah, yes, indeed. I think the other thing that was important about the state of the teeth, if I remember rightly, was natural probiotics in the gut and stuff that seemed to have disappeared.
Well, yeah, you need those across the board.
Yeah. Well, that particular part of our conversation has resulted in a new interest, because we went on a fermentation demonstration and a play shop, basically, is what it was. And it was a really, really inspiring night out. And we've got several yeast beasts now growing on the hearth and are looking at coming up with kombucha and what was the other one that you told me about? Kefir.
Yeah, exactly. Excellent. Good.
And, I mean, that's effectively... It seems to me that it's not only stuff that's good for kind of producing bacteria that you need in your gut, but it actually seems to improve the food nutritionally as well. Have you been using these kind of live fermentation techniques yourself?
Yeah, I go in waves. I like fermenting foods for. A couple of years I was doing kefir like mad and thought it was fantastic, and I got bored of it. And then I started fermenting sort of cabbage, onion, chili, garlic, that sort of thing. Then I got really bored of that, couldn't handle it for a while. Now I'm liking it again. Then I went through fermenting things like tomatoes, peppers, onions, garlic, chili, making that sort of Mexican salsa type tomato-y thing. But you can ferment, as you know, anything at all.
It is absolutely astonishing. It is. The book, I haven't got it with me at the moment, called Wild Fermentation, it's full of examples from all over the world and right across time. I particularly like, actually, the little ones that involve chilies and things like that you can use as a bit of a pickle. I mean, if you because obviously as a new interest there's going to be all sorts of things popping out, ginger beer, all manner of things. Is there any danger of you taking too much of this stuff, having spent 50 years slaughtering your gut bacteria? Can you do yourself any harm? Can you overdo it in any way?
Yes. Yeah, if somebody was really delicate and rather ill, rather old, for instance, you'd want to start them really slowly, whether we're talking about colloidal silver, whether we're talking about fermented foods. One's got to be careful with the old and the delicate, and start slowly, unless it's an emergency.
Mm-hmm. But for the rest of us, we can experiment with this pretty safe, probably more safely than we can experiment with the NHS anyway.
Well, like everything, a bit of knowledge goes a long way. Anybody wants to know about fermentation, there's a half-hour video by John Bergman. Go onto YouTube, put John Bergman fermentation, and in half an hour you'll be an expert.
Brilliant. It's certainly one of the, it's something that it sort of had crossed my desk a few years back, but I hadn't really paid it very much attention. It wasn't until I found myself amongst a bunch of enthusiasts and got to taste some of the drinks and foods they were making that I realised that I had really been missing something.
It's a fantastic thing, and it's super healthy. I mean, I can't say how healthy it is. I've had people who've come to me and said they've had diarrhea for 9 months. I mean, how horrible must that be? 9 months of diarrhea, dangerous. 3 days after drinking water kefir, fixed. Completely cured. 3 days. Doctors been giving him drugs for 9 months with no result.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? It's really great. It's one of the things that first struck me about one of your vids I saw was you were talking about news from the health world, all of it good, I'm glad to say, which is tremendously uplifting in this day and age, I must say.
Well, quite. I mean, anybody who's ill, if they go onto Google and put in their problem with the words natural cure, they'll almost certainly, on the front page of Google, first page, find out various true answers.
And then you can start actually experimenting with them yourself, and as we were discussing earlier, by seeing whether it makes a difference, you can demonstrate change and demonstrate that the decision to take responsibility for your own health can be effective, which could be a massive step for many people, couldn't it?
Well, when it comes to natural health, let's say, turmeric we were discussing earlier, if you studied it for 5 minutes, you would probably know double what your doctor knows. And that's giving them the benefit of the doubt. You study it for 10 minutes. You study it for an hour. You study it for a couple of hours. You're now going to be a world's leading expert amongst medical doctors, virtually, except for the few that know. I mean, some doctors are really into it. I mean, a lot of doctors have given up being a doctor, stopped their medical license in order that they can do it naturally. Even doctors are waking up. But
yes.
Of course, the moment they do that, their income drops by 3/4.
Yes, but I'd say their job satisfaction maybe rises a little.
Well, that's it. What a lot of people don't realise, let's say somebody gets a really serious disease, cancer or something, and they've got some money. So they think, well, what's the best thing I can do? Well, my health is more important than anything, so I'm going to go private. This, if you're a cancer patient, might be the worst mistake you've ever made, as opposed to going NHS. If you go private, those oncology doctors are on commission. They sell you £500,000 worth of chemotherapy. What are they going to take, 30% profit? Let's say you happen to be slightly dishonest, and there's this person, well, they're going to die anyway, should we sell them another round of chemo, make 10 grand, make 50 grand, whatever it might be? I mean, it's corruption.
It's a confusion of terms, isn't it? Because when we say when I think of going private, I mean going seeking my own private means of sorting this out rather than going to a bit of the corporate world that is simply labelled private. But I mean, there's actually quite a lot of things hemming you around in the NHS that give you a bit of peripheral support when you go for treatment, that as far as I can gather are entirely missing from most private hospitals, any kind of accident and emergency support, or just the kind of knowledge you were talking about early amongst emergency room staff, is mostly absent from private hospitals, isn't it?
Yes, you don't get any in private hospitals normally. I interviewed Valerie Warwick, who was an oncology nurse for 17 years, and I asked her questions like, when you were a nurse and working in private oncology, working for in private doctors, did you ever see chemotherapy sold to the patient when everybody knew it would never work? And she said, all the time.
Yeah. It was really shown to me when my my father, who'd been treated for what they said was prostate cancer for a couple of years, finally contracted lung cancer. And what was recommended was a full dose of radiation to the head, which killed him in pretty short order. It was a pretty shocking experience, really, and I've met several other people who've had to undergo chemo of one sort or another since then. And I just can't help feeling that there must be a better way of dealing with it.
Well, chemo has a success rate lower than 3%, and I believe the people who chemo apparently claims to cure survive despite the chemo.
Mm-hmm. Well, 3% is barely statistically significant.
Well, it's not. The thing is that they cheat these statistics. So a lot of doctors actually believe the statistics are better, but all you've got to do is look at the statistics, read them through properly, and one will discover that the real survival rate is under 3%. It's shocking.
Mm. And that most people, I guess, who it says cancer on the death certificate, quite possibly died of aspects of the treatment rather than of the disease they were believed to have.
Yeah, absolutely. So if anybody were to say this to their doctor, the doctor would come back and say, look at these statistics. It shows that the risk is, let's say, much smaller than that. They say, there's a 60% survival rate. And how they get away with that is there is the real rate or the relative rate. So what they do is statistics. They take two groups of people and they say, they take somebody who's got a very rare condition, and it's too late in the evening for me to properly explain it, but they cheat the statistics between relative risk and real risk. Ask me another day. I've been up since 5, so
yeah, I realise it's been a long day for you. You still happy to go on for a few minutes, or would you?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, because the chat box is kicking with questions for you. We've got John Jay has asked. This is another question that I was interested in asking myself, actually, is whether you've got any opinions on hydrogen peroxide treatment.
For a dead cheap, effective route, it can be brilliant, yeah. I would consider nebulizing hydrogen peroxide as a good method to look into yourself. I'm not telling anybody to do anything. I'm just saying interesting areas of research would be look at nebulizing. Got to be less than 3%. It's got to be food grade. And if you're going to breathe anything in, you just want to test it in your mouth to begin with, make sure it all feels perfect.
And what's it intended to achieve?
Well, if somebody had got you see, oxygen is a good thing. You know, there's an antioxidant effect and there's an oxidant effect. You know, everybody knows about the antioxidant effect of vitamin C, for example. But there's every advantage of having oxygen, an oxidant as well. Both are good. And hydrogen peroxide provides oxygen galore. But is it the oxygen you want, or is it the hydrogen of hydrogen peroxide? Hydrogen is much more important from a health perspective than oxygen. If you're flooded with hydrogen, things are going to go well. And one of the things I'm looking at primarily at the moment is adding hydrogen to water. So hydrogen peroxide is a very cheap way to do it, but it's not the best way. Ozone, medical grade ozone would be another step up. Using a hydrogen stick would be a way to put hydrogen into water. You could, I structure my water because I want more hydrogen. Hydrogen peroxide has been known, people who've had cancer have found that they've used it and it's reversed. Hydrogen peroxide is a massively powerful molecule.
So is it putting more oxygen into the water? What's it doing?
Water is H2O. Hydrogen peroxide is H2O2. So there's double the oxygen in hydrogen peroxide than there is in water. So, yes, you're putting, and it's unstable. So you drink it in diluted form, 3% or less, and, yes, you're putting oxygen straight in the body.
Right, because I remember again hearing you say that we've got a lot less oxygen in the air nowadays than we would have had a few thousand years back, and so we perhaps do need to be looking at improving that a little bit.
Well, 40% oxygen plus not that long ago, 20% now. Mm. So half the oxygen in the world, it's only because they cut down the forests.
Yeah, the lungs of the planet.
And two acres are going every minute, apparently, at the moment, or something like that. Ecuador just sold a third of their rainforest to China.
Yes, apparently Colombia has sold all of its water to China. Which is a pretty stunning thought, really. You do wonder what sort of game these people think they're playing.
I'm sure the people of Colombia didn't need the water.
But of course not. Who needs water, eh? And I'm sure the Chinese can do plenty shipping it across there for whatever they want to do with it. Here's one from Muppet for you. It says, Muppet says, what real choice do cancer patients have? Hobson's choice, NHS or certain death? Do you think that's the choice they've really got?
Well, clearly, they need to investigate for themselves cancer natural cures. The most fantastic video is doing the rounds just at the moment. You've got to be very quick to catch it, perhaps. It's called The Truth About Cancer. Go onto YouTube, put in The Truth About Cancer. Watch episodes 6 and 7, for the really important episodes. It's the best cancer movie I've ever seen, ever, times 10. It's just fantastic. Truth About Cancer. Ty Bollinger.
Yeah, I've just seen that. In fact, I think that somebody's just put the link for that into the chat box.
It's going viral worldwide, and if enough people watch that, that will change the face of health forever, because it's the most brilliantly made film on the subject I've ever seen.
It still remains my fundamental hope and trust, in fact, that there are many, many people now aware of what's going on, and that it might not take much sooner or later for the whole game to change as a result of people taking on information that's been in front of them for a long time but they haven't been willing to take on board. I look forward to seeing that video.
Well, it's just a race right now. I mean, GC Math,
What is GC Math? I've heard you've mentioned it a couple of times. What is it?
Well, it's a human protein. You've got it in your body right now. And it was discovered 25 years ago by Dr. Yamamoto in Japan. And it's one of the biggest cover-ups out. Over the years, it's been discovered that 50... of these named diseases can be improved or reversed if you put if you make sure you have enough GCMAF in your body. So you right now have got a couple of billionths of a gram of GCMAF, but if you're seriously ill, the chances are that you won't have any. So you can make GCMAF using kefir and colostrum. It's a fermented product. And if anybody goes onto YouTube and puts GCMAF, 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 the amazing answer for your health, they'll see a video that I filmed early last year about GCMAF and what it does. And it is probably the most important molecule that you could possibly consider at the minute. Autistic children are no longer autistic. People have reversed the symptoms of cancer. All sorts of remarkable results have been shown with this molecule. So how does the UK react? They raid the laboratory making it and steal everything.
Which is, of course, to completely miss the point that you can actually transmit the frequency of GCMAF without needing the laboratory.
Yes, but it's not as successful as the real thing. Really need is the real thing.
Why do you suppose that's the case?
Because while we are beings of frequency, we are very much physical, and you want it to happen quickly? Well, the physical does it pretty quickly.
Okay, and is GCMAF available in its physical form?
Well, not to the English market, it's not, because the English have banned it. But in anywhere else in the world, it's legal.
God, like I say, anyone would think they didn't have our best interests at heart, eh?
Well, they're saving you from themselves. in the Ty Bollinger film, The Truth About Cancer, there's a child who died, and before the child died, it was four, they took the authorities to court. And the judge decided that the treatment might be more dangerous than death, so they wouldn't let the natural treatment happen, and the child died. You know, they actually said this could be more dangerous than death. just can't believe it.
Well, I'm sure there are things that are more dangerous than death, but it doesn't sound like that's one of them.
Well, I don't know. But the system is crazy, so, you know, the idea is everybody wakes up.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. I look forward to seeing The Truth About Cancer, and I'll look at the GCMAF, because I hadn't heard about that before. Can we perhaps talk about a couple of alternative means of diagnosis that I've come across whilst looking at your videos and things? One of them is a bioresonance scan.
I was testing out one which looked really promising but wasn't as promising as I'd hoped. However, bioresonance and bioresonance scanning can be fantastic, but some machines are totally unreliable and untrustworthy. And some are brilliant. I'm testing out a new one at the moment, and I'll tell you the results in a few months.
So was the machine that we were investigating at the Conscious Tribal Gathering, was that claiming to be a bioresonance machine?
It was, and basically what turned out was very funny. The back end of it was rigged, so that, and a lot of the bioresonance companies rig their back end slightly. It's a bit like this. All the bioresonance machines are hard to replicate the result, and so people criticize it because, look, the result this time is different to what it was 5 minutes ago. And that's this whole quantum thing that, you know, like the observer effect, you know, they've shown that things happen differently at a quantum level if somebody's looking at it. And so to counter those sort of effects, what they often do is they rig the back end so it knows you've been tested once. So when you get tested the second time, the computer deliberately lines up the second time's results to look more like the first time. See what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what I found that machine to be doing, cheating. I caught it cheating.
Mm.
And so that while I couldn't catch it cheating at the front end, even then I wasn't that happy with the results. And so what I think they were doing is you put in your weight, you put in your age, and it coughed up what the most likely things were for somebody of your sex, age, and height and weight and so on. I mean, quite honestly, everybody's low on magnesium. Everybody's low on most things. And I think it was just randomly spewing out common things.
Mm.
But then I noticed that everybody was not low on iodine when I know that everybody is. And then I started doing tests on the machine. In the end, we hotwired it. And whereas it still thought it was registering a human, even though it was registering a banana. You know, everybody, including the guy who sold it to me, it took me 150 tests to conclusively realize that it was a very, very clever trick that was being played by the machine. But the guy who sold it to me, who's a very well-known London practitioner, still is 100% convinced that the machine is genuine. Though I proved to him that the back end is rigged. I couldn't prove the front end, but he's convinced it works.
But in principle, it's still... Because it really struck me as being something a bit like that, the tricorder from Star Trek, where it would be really great to be able to get a decent readout of somebody's health using a machine like that, because...
Well, you can. The thing about that one, do you remember, it was incredibly cheap?
Yeah, I do.
And that was the problem. If you spend 10 times that much, or 50 times that much, you get the most brilliant machine that reads your mind, let alone your body.
Mm.
But you know, that one was clever software tricking everybody.
Because it does strike me that if we can... I mean, there was a time when I realised that the NHS treatments were not quite as good as they might be because of experience I was having. But for quite a long time, I did believe that their diagnostics were possibly worth investigating. Nowadays, it seems to me that a lot of the NHS's diagnostics are themselves actually pretty dangerous, and that we do need a machine such as the one you're describing, or at least it would be extremely useful to have such a thing. Because if nothing else, you could kind of back up that way if the decisions you're making as a result of the symptoms that are being presented, or the dry skin on the elbows or anything like that. It'd be really great to be able to back it up with a bit of technology, I would assume, wouldn't it?
Well, quite. I mean, the bioresonance machine I'm working now, which really does work, tests thousands and thousands of parameters, and there's so much to test that it can take hours. Literally hours to run through things. And then once you've got all the frequencies of everything with the bioresonance, you can then send the opposite back. So, you know, it shows exactly what you're low on. So you can literally send into the body every frequency that you were low on. And
absolutely brilliant.
And again, you can do it once you've got to have the person there physically to to measure them. But after that, then you can broadcast the signal to them. But there are other bioresonance scanners. The one I really want, if you buy the full bells and whistles version, $17,000. But with that one, you get a portable testing device. So I could post you this little hand cradle. You connect it to your computer, touch it, and then I can get your results, you know, on the other side of the planet. But I'll say that one... Well, the cheapest version is about $12,000 for that one. But it's incredible. You know, I can tell everything about you, even though you're not in the room.
It's completely astonishing, really. It's just like, I mean, it was years ago that I heard that they could do similar things with expensive blood tests, but it is amazing to think that such technology might become available at the grassroots.
But this is old technology. Most German doctors use bioresonance. It's been around for over 30 years. Most German doctors use this type of equipment, whereas English doctors probably get struck off if they tried.
It's funny how some aspects of German culture seem to be making it over here and others don't. I wonder why things seem to be under such why things seem to be so tightly locked down here as opposed to in Europe in some ways.
While having a semblance of freedom, it has meant that different medical strands, schools, have gone off in slightly different directions. I mean, you mentioned diagnostic. Well, what are the best diagnostic? Well, if you're going to diagnose breast cancer 8 years earlier than a mammogram, and mammograms are proved to cause more cancer than they cure, a thermogram, infrared cameras, will spot breast cancer 8 years earlier than a mammogram can.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because that is something that I did invest in 2 or 3 years back when I was seriously worried about my health. I went and had a thermoluminescent reading body scan, which is a very interesting experience and was actually quite revealing. Have you had a lot of experience of those?
Only what I've read and people have explained to me in videos that I've watched. I've never had enough cash to go out and buy one.
No, I just went and had a reading on one. I didn't get the machine.
I'm sorry, didn't catch that.
Yeah, I just went and had a reading on one. I didn't actually buy the machine.
All right. For some reason, the line's gone rubbish and I could barely hear that. But other diagnostics... About 30 years ago, I was shown, at that point, in the optical business, I was selling microscopes for looking at eyes with, and I sold one to this optometrist. He said, oh, let me look at your eyes. He said, I do iridology, the study of looking at the iris and seeing the marks. And he told me immediately that I was type 1 diabetic. He spotted all sorts of little things. I had a backache at the time. He spotted almost everything about me from looking at the eyes. Took him less than a minute.
Yes, I've met a couple of iridologists who seem to be quite prescient. There seems to be all manner of ways of basically finding out what our needs are and of then actually meeting those needs. I think you're doing a fine job at bringing all this stuff to the fore, Clive. I really do. What do you think, if people are only going to do, because we're coming up to the end, we'll play out with some music. What if people could only do 2 or 3 things for themselves, what do you think would by and large be the best way of people approaching their health if they were starting from cold?
I would suggest that the Celtic salt would be the number one thing. If they're not drinking enough water, they should consider doing that. Increasing their water, maybe filtering the water. If you're drinking it from the tap, don't. If you're drinking out of a plastic bottle, don't. You either want it from a glass bottle, or you want to make sure you've filtered or used a 20-quid ozone generator to ozonate the water and make it pure, or as pure as you can. There are two different types of water. It's either recycled sewage with everybody's drugs like Prozac and Viagra and birth control pills and so on in it, getting stronger and stronger every time. They can't filter that stuff out. And so if you're drinking recycled sewage, you want to take a lot more care than if you're just getting normal, nice water and the only thing that's wrong with it is chlorine. So an ozone generator, 20 quid eBay, there's a make called Health First, which are very reliable. I'd buy one of those if it was recycled sewage and bubble ozone through all the water that you use, whether it's the bath, whether it's cooking, whether it's drinks, and it purifies everything except fluoride, pretty much.
Okay, and the fluoride we said we could deal with by adding something to the water earlier on. Can't remember what it was.
Borax.
Borax, that was it.
And then if people want to go to my website, clivedecarle.com, look on products. I'm just about to add a whole host of products, but if they click through to Ancient Purity through my site, I get a small commission, and it keeps me doing the work I'm doing.
Great. Well, I'll be, after this chat, I'll be having another look at the website. Like I say, I'll be picking up my pack of essentials tomorrow. We've got perhaps a couple of quickies that have come through in the chat box before I let you go. Rick has asked, have you come across the use of mushrooms and fungi for improved health?
Absolutely. Every mushroom is anti-cancer. All the mushrooms are great. You know, the famous health mushrooms are cordyceps. You know, in the Chinese, when the Chinese emperors were at it, cordyceps was like swan in England. If you get caught with it, you know, you're in big trouble. Cordyceps mushrooms were for only the emperor's lot. And so cordyceps reishi, lion's mane, there are lots of famous mushrooms. Even, the mushrooms on a pizza are good for you and anti-cancer. The mushrooms are hugely powerful. If nobody's seen it, there's a TED talk called Six Ways Mushrooms Will Save the Planet with Paul Stamets, who's the world-leading mushroom.
Absolutely excellent, that one was.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, clean up oil spills, everything.
Yeah. Yes, and as was mentioned in the chat box, there's an earlier Dr. Rock podcast where I was at a Ted Gillam workshop and he was talking about mushrooms. That's a very good one as well. So they're really up and coming, the mushrooms, aren't they? It's really fairly new discoveries, and they seem to have hidden within them solutions to many, again, external environmental as well as internal environmental problems. And finally, for you, sorry,
yeah, I was going to say that it's hardly new. The Chinese were writing about it 3,000 years ago.
Yeah, fair point. Yeah,
and I got it right then.
Yeah. Seems so much to be remembering stuff that we've forgotten.
If people are interested in mushrooms, I've got some chaga mushrooms from Siberia, which are the famous, chaga mushroom has been written about for a very long time. And if anybody wants some chaga mushroom, I've got some from the forests of Siberia. If anybody wants to get in touch with me, if they go to clivesacarl.com, they can.
That's for chaga tea, isn't it? I remember the chaga tea and the turkey tail mushrooms are the two that seem to be riding particularly high in terms of human health.
Well, the chaga tastes so nice. You know, some of the mushrooms don't taste very good, the medicinal ones, but chaga is delicious in tea.
Very good. And a last question from Laurie, from our main admin. She's asking about a substance called saw palmetto, and as far as I can work out, it's spelt SAWPALMETTO. She says she's heard it shrinks the size of the prostate. Have you heard of this stuff? Got any comment on it?
Yeah, that's what it's famous for prostate issues. And you can get saw palmetto berries. You don't have to get it in capsules or whatever. You can just get the real thing. Yeah, again, put saw palmetto, how to use. And lots of people get fabulous results, but anybody with prostate also needs to consider that they're probably low on selenium, they're probably low on zinc. They need to, again, put in prostate natural cure. They should find the answer. Go on to earthclinic.com. Loads of answers there. They can consult me, clivesacarl.com. But so many of these problems, if they buy the Ancient Purity Essentials kit, they'll probably find that, you know, the majority of problems go away because, you know, while everybody's problems might be different, everybody's got the same underlying issue, which is a lack of health. And so, you know, if you've got all the minerals, all the vitamins, all the probiotics, the digestive enzymes and the detox elements, most people are going to get their health back, and therefore whatever the problem used to be illness-wise, they haven't got it anymore.
Well, that's absolutely marvellous, Clive, that is. I'd really like to thank you for all that information, for the time you spent with us. It'd be really great to have you come back at some point, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure, there's lots to talk about.
There certainly is, and I'm going to be watching your videos on YouTube and coming up with lots of questions. Right now, though, I'm really desperate to go for a wee break, so I'm going to say thank you very much to Clive, my guest, and put on some music. And I'll get in touch with you very shortly, Clive. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. And I've got a show at 7 o'clock on People's Internet Radio. I'm going to be interviewing Greg Caton, who's amazing.
Excellent.
7 o'clock Saturday.